Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Longevity is something to which everyone no doubt aspires. Advances in science and medicine seem likely to increase the odds of that. Then what? The average lifespan has increased over the years, but so have cases of dementia, general frailty, and incidents of outliving financial resources. The average lifespan in this country is now very close to 79 years, 10 years more than half a century ago. Women continue to outlive men by about 5 years today. It was seven half a century ago. I'm Don Marsh. Longevity is our subject on today's program, The Upside and Downside of Living Longer Lives. With me in studio, Dr. John Morley is director of the Division of Geriatric Medicine at St. Louis University. Brian Carpenter conducts research on aging. He's associate professor of psychology at Washington University, currently teaching a class titled, with thanks to the Beatles, I'm sure, When I Am 64, Transforming Your Future. Michelle Clark is financial advisor and founder of Clark Hourly Financial Planning. Thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to have you. Dr. Morley, let me start with you, and just to get the basics covered here, why are we living longer?
We're living longer because fundamentally we have better food and more food. We have better medicine, and on the whole, life is a lot better from when we went back to 1900, where most people lived at about 49 years of age. Now we've made a huge leap forward. Our leap forward in this country has not been close to that of other countries. So Monaco, for instance, where Princess Reina Grace lived and other people like that, they lived till 89. Even places like Singapore are living about 5 years longer than we are. So small states and then Japan live a lot longer. So we've got a ways to go, and the questions really are why. And it appears that in most places people walk a lot to work, and then we come to the States and we take a car. So increasing exercise clearly is a piece of it. In many of the places where people live a long time, they eat a large amount of fish, and then the Mediterranean diet. And these things stand out as things that really make a big difference. So adding olive oil to your food appears to make a huge difference as far as memory is concerned, as also getting rid of heart disease. So there are lots of things we can do. We have improved. Recognize that over that 50-odd years that we have improved our lifespan a lot, we're also starting to get far too fat. So we need to cut back early, because when you get older, you can't afford to lose weight. Weight loss as you get older turns out to be killing. So we have a much better lifestyle. We have things we can do, and we're doing some of them. But we also need good medical care for everybody. And longevity depends on good care, starting with children. Aging is a pediatric disease, so not extending Medicaid, you know, in the state is like totally stupid, because that's going to hurt our children's children's children at this stage. And I don't know why we don't understand. It starts early. Do good things early. Get your kids to exercise early. Get them good medical care, and they will become great adults if they're well educated, and they'll live much longer, maybe reach 122 like Madame Jean Comeau did. We can do it.
Thank you for that overview. Very, very impressive. Brian Carpenter, living longer can be both a blessing and a curse. Can it not?
That's very true. I think there are one of the things that people often think about when they realize that the population is aging is that the first images that come to mind are usually negative images or bad images, people trapped in nursing homes, unable to take care of themselves, not engaged any longer. But I think it's important to realize that there are some challenges ahead as our population grows older, but also some opportunities if we can face them squarely and figure out how to deal with some of these challenges we haven't ever faced before in human history.
Well, let's quickly talk about the challenges and the opportunities. What are they in both cases?
I think one challenge, there are challenges across the board. It doesn't matter what industry, what profession you're talking about. If you're not familiar with aging and older adults, you need to be familiar with them, because that's going to be the population that's going to make up, by some suggestions, around 20% of the population by 2040 or 2050. Mm-hmm. So to take one example, housing is going to be a challenge that our society is going to be facing in the future. Years ago, we fell in love with our cars, and the suburbs grew and grew and grew. But most people will spend an average of 7 years of their life unable to drive. So if you're stuck in the suburbs without a car, or with a car but unable to drive that car, you're going to have a tough time getting to do the things that you want to do.
So, of course, if you can walk, that will help you perhaps live even longer.
Definitely, definitely. Mm-hmm. So we need to figure out from a kind of community perspective, how do we situate housing? What kind of housing do we need to allow people to be as independent for as long as possible?
Right. And the opportunities, we've talked about the challenges, opportunities.
Well, to take employment as a possible opportunity, you know, people have many jobs over their lifespan. And when Social Security was started, they decided that 65 was going to be the age at which mm-hmm. people would stop working. But that was based on some actuarial data.
Because people died when they were 65 right. back in the 30s.
Right. So if you were going to retire at 65, you know, that meant you were going to have a short but pleasant retirement. Now, if you retire at 65, some people are, if you're in your life expectancy is going to be around 80, then you've got a lot of time to spend. And being on vacation for 15 years may sound like a great idea, but there's nothing in the psychological literature to suggest that a 15-year vacation is really best for people's mental health. So I think the opportunity is for us to figure out how to stay engaged, how to stay in the workforce, or volunteering or other activities that are meaningful and productive.
But of course, you've got all the younger people knocking on the door. They want to get the older folks out of the way so they can move up the ladder.
Mm-hmm. That's true. So that's a policy decision we're going to need to make, is how do we deal with the fact that there are going to be multiple generations competing for some of the same resources.
Michelle, that brings us to you very, very quickly. Among the challenges, obviously, is having the resources, the financial resources, to be able to afford those later years. How do you see these challenges?
I agree with employment in retirement years as being one of the opportunities. It's also a challenge that I see a lot of the clients with which I work facing. One of the things that a lot of folks will say is, you know, make sure that you have the opportunity to work in retirement. But the truth of the matter is that we saw in the last economic downturn is that those folks that are in their 60s are the first to be let go. And it's because they're the most highly compensated. And the challenge that I saw is that people were waiting to pay off their mortgages after the kids were sent to college. And that was when they were going to shovel all their money into their retirement accounts and they were going to pay off their mortgages. And they were planning on making their money at their highest earnings years. And so what I would advise folks to do is, if you do plan to work later in retirement, is to have some way that you can rely on yourself to be employed, have some sort of skill that you could consult and not rely on a corporation to keep you employed. Another challenge or something that I tell folks is the greatest risk to your retirement is longevity risk. A lot of people think that it's the risk in the stock market, but in fact, it's longevity risk, and that's simply defined as outliving your resources. And things like Social Security and taking your pension as monthly benefit rather than rolling it over as a lump sum, that's a way to put that risk off on someone else so that you make sure that you're getting money for the rest of your life if you live to 100 years old, rather than having to worry about, will my money last?
There's one other element here, and then we'll move on to some other things. But one other element is, in an economic situation such as we found ourselves in the last few years, younger people today have been cashing out their 401ks
yes.
In order to deal with the economic pressures. And, of course, where is that going to leave them when they reach 64 or 65 or well beyond?
That is the worst thing they can do, because as we've all heard many times, the time is on your side when you're investing, and they need that money to be invested for the long haul. And so if you're going to be expected to have a longer lifespan and you're a young person, you need that money to be invested for the long haul.
Yeah. Well, that I think that's probably pretty obvious. Dr. Morley, back to you. What is science up to with regard to reversing the aging process? You mentioned the figure living to be 120 or so. I've seen that figure a lot. I don't know why it keeps popping
because
up.
Because there's one lady who got over 120. She made 122. So we know it is feasible. That's a reasonable reason. It doesn't mean we can't live longer than that, but it's going to take a long time before the majority of people live longer than 120.
And where are we now? I mean, where is science? You've mentioned the things that we can do from the Mediterranean diet to walking more. But what about science's role?
So I understand that we all want to talk about science. We spend an inordinate amount of money on science and trying to find new wonder drugs that are going to make us live forever. Recognize that anything I say about the things you're asking me to say are only useful once you're walking more, once you are eating well, once you're using your mind. If you're doing those things, then we can look at science. Recently, there have been some fascinating experiments taking two mice, putting them together so they share the same circulation. And you put a young mouse and an old mouse together. And it turns out that the old mouse will actually have better brain power and the nerves will start to grow. In addition to that, it will have better muscle and its heart will regress to looking more like a young heart. So there's stuff in our blood that allows us to live longer. And people have found fancy things like GDF-13. Turns out testosterone is also important, at least in the mice, for this sort of thing. So there are things that we're looking for. But the problem with doing longevity drugs is we get very excited. We say, well, caloric restriction is good for you, but we can't do that study. And we know that animals, when they get old, if we calorically restrict them, die earlier than they would otherwise. So we don't really always know what's going to work. And these long-term studies take a long time to come. The other big piece of science, which is going to be really important but is going to be somewhat expensive, is high technology. We know now that you've got people who can basically stand up with these wonderful jumpsuits, who are paraplegic and walk again. You can give people new arms. You can let people stay much longer at home. In Europe, the European Union has put huge amounts of money into developing whole villages where they're wired for high-tech things so you can monitor the person at home, make sure they're getting all the things they need at home. But that development is going to take time. We in the States have lagged behind both Europe and Japan and Korea, where they have great robots that will pick you up and carry you around. There was Frank and the robot was a great movie where basically he taught the robot to help him steal, which I thought was really good. But you've got to recognize that we've got a ways to go. We've got to do the simple things first. So please, exercise, olive oil, eat well, don't drink too much, try to avoid smoking. Those are really good things to do, and then the science will come along slowly behind you.
Brian Carpenter, what does your research show you about this?
So we're focused, our research is more psychological, more social, and we're interested in understanding more what happens to relationships as they evolve over the many, many years that people are living. And I think there's an intersection of two trends here that's interesting. One is this trend of people living older. And the other trend is that families are, by definition, becoming more diverse than they used to be. Decades ago, we thought of a family as being a husband and a wife and two kids, 2.2 kids and a dog. And now in the decades ahead, families are going to look very different. They already do look very different in terms of their ethnic makeup, in terms of their family structure, in terms of the number of generations that are going to be alive at one time. And so when we, back 30, 40 years ago, we all kind of understood what family members' roles and responsibilities were. There were norms for how people were supposed to act and how they were supposed to take care of their parents. And that's going to completely change. We don't know what the norms are going to be like because families are going to look so different in the next decades ahead.
I have to take a break, but very quickly, why are the Europeans better at this than we are in terms of longevity?
Well, one of the reasons is that they've been aging faster than we have in terms of their countries. So some of the countries in Western Europe are demographically where we're going to be a few years from now. So they've already had these challenges to deal with.
And they also a social society where the government puts money into maintaining, helping the family keep somebody at home, for instance. It makes a big difference. And while socialism is often a dirty word in the United States, as we get to having an older population, our choices are going to be just to leave them to their own resources or develop a way to give them the resources, which either Michelle is going to have to come up with great ways to have enough money to do this, or alternatively, the government is going to have to invest a lot more in aging.
Well, we'll pick up on these points when we come back. I am a little pessimistic about what you've just said about the government's involvement in all of this, given the financial condition of our governments these days. But we'll pick up on these points in just a moment. We're talking about longevity. We would certainly like to take your questions or comments related to living longer at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you prefer to send us a tweet, do so at STL on Air. My guests in studio are Dr. John Morley, Director of the Division of Geriatric Medicine at St. Louis University. Brian Carpenter conducts research on aging, and he's currently teaching at Washington University. Michelle Clark is a financial advisor and founder of Clark Hourly Financial Planning. We'll come back, continue the conversation in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio 90.7, KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back as we continue our conversation on longevity. But before we continue that discussion, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. A lawsuit has been filed that seeks to strike down an agreement capping the amount of solar rebates that Missouri's largest utilities must pay. The lawsuit, filed by supporters of the rebates, asks a Cole County judge to invalidate agreements approved last year by state utility regulators involving Ameren, Missouri, and Kansas City Power and Light Company. A Missouri death row inmate with an execution scheduled for July is asking Governor Jay Nixon to appoint an independent panel to review his clemency request. 54-year-old John Middleton is scheduled to die July 16th for the 1995 drug-related killings of three people in northern Missouri. And St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Belleville today announced plans to build a new health care facility in O'Fallon, Illinois. The $300 million hospital will be built on property at Interstate 64 and Green Mount Road. St. Elizabeth's will continue to operate the facility in Belleville as well. You can find out more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation on longevity. We're with Dr. John Morley, Brian Carpenter, and Michelle Clark. And I want to just pick up on this point of socializing, the importance of socializing in older age. We think in terms of nursing homes, but what we're hearing today is there's kind of a new system being developed whereby people stay at home, but they form groups whereby they are socializing and interacting. Michelle, are you running into this in your field? Is something that you're looking at or telling people about?
I've not come across this in my experience in my field. I have read about this, though, in my reading.
How about you, Brian Carpenter?
This is actually, we're glad that this is happening because most of the psychological research suggests that when you've got good social relationships, and we're talking about good relationships with family members or friends, that really conveys a lot of benefits and maybe even have some physical benefits or medical benefits. So for no matter how people seek out these kinds of social relationships, social engagement, that's a really good thing for folks.
John Morley, I know you would probably agree with that.
So keeping in contact with life and with people, not only old people but younger people as well, is extraordinarily important. Coping skills come from having a good support system. So if you have a partner who's with you and you've been together a long time, you'll do better. And very importantly is recognition that behavior therapy provided by psychologists, social workers, is actually much better than many of the drugs we have available. And as people get older, things like cognition stimulation therapy for trying to improve the mind, for instance, works at least as well as any drugs we've got at the moment. It's extraordinarily important that we learn to accept help and interaction as we get older. Without that, we're going to run into trouble.
How important, Brian, is staying at home, being able to stay at home?
Well, that varies from person to person. For some people, they actually welcome the opportunity to move from a home they may have been in for a while because it may bring on more stress having to take care of that large home that they're not able to take care of any longer. So for some people, moving is something that they look forward to. Other people want to try to live in their house that they've been in as long as possible. And so I think that there's a great opportunity there to figure out how do we make that happen for people. If they want to stay in their own home, how do we help them stay independent and in that place?
But so many of our older citizens wind up in nursing homes, and I think we all have a vague idea if we've not experienced it through our own families. How expensive that can be, Michelle. It can be extraordinarily expensive. Unless you're wealthy, how do you manage that?
It can be expensive. When I run analysis to see if someone can afford to pay out of pocket for long-term care, in the state of Missouri, in the St. Louis area, we estimate that it's about $56,000 a year in today's dollars for long-term care expenses. That's for a private room. We use a 5% inflation rate on that per year, and then we assume that they will have about a two-year stay toward the end of their life. And so it could be about $700,000 out of pocket for long-term care. And there's not very many portfolios that can withstand something like that, and that's assuming only one person. So the scenarios we typically run to see if they can withstand that is the wife will take care of the husband, and the husband passes, and then the wife will have a two-year stay at the end of their life. And we see, can this portfolio withstand that? And for most of the people with which I work, the answer is typically no. The second layer of that is a lot of the people with which I work have means for a retirement. And we ask them, would you want to stay in an average nursing home? And a lot of people say, well, no. A lot of the nursing homes I've seen, I wouldn't want to stay in an average nursing home. I'd like to have a nicer one. And I have them price some of the nursing homes. And when we run that, they absolutely couldn't stay in a place they'd always pictured. So they would need to have long-term care insurance to fund at least a portion of it.
But most people probably don't start thinking about that sort of thing until they're pretty close to retirement themselves, and that makes it also very expensive.
There are some factors. I'm often the first one to bring it up to them, often the one that's telling them how much it costs. And there's another factor to this. Long-term care insurance goes up significantly at age 60. The industry has gone through some incredibly significant changes over the last 18 months. Many of the providers have gotten out of the industry because they're actually having to pay for care at a much greater rate than they had anticipated when they ran their numbers. They're finding that because women are the ones that are using it, they're now making women pay a higher premium, which makes sense because
they live longer.
They're the ones utilizing it. When you look for car insurance for a 16-year-old boy, which I have this year, you have to pay more for a 16-year-old boy for car insurance. And so the same concept is being applied now for women. They're now also having people do paramedical
training?
Oh, no, they're having women, they're having people go through paramedical exams, making you step on a scale, take blood tests, and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of changes that didn't used to happen in long-term care.
John Morley, that's an interesting aspect of this, and that is when we think of old people and the expenses they pay, we don't often think of how this is affecting other industries and other things, like the insurance industry. They have to kind of go with the punches as well.
So there are two pieces to this. There are a large number of industries that are actually going to do much better because they're going to provide specific services to older people, certainly creating group homes, for instance, or groups where people can live together is an alternative to nursing homes. Improving the quality and care in nursing homes has come a long way in the United States. We have some of the best nursing homes in the world, and as you go around the world, we most probably are better than most places. But we have to recognize that that's another industry that's going to grow. Looking at specific foods that might be better for older people, specific packaging, all of this is important. But again, all of this is going to cost more money. And then you've got to remember that inflation Michelle was talking about, because I think your example was a car and a house. A house when I started out, $35,000, a car today, the same, right, Michelle?
Yeah, right. In a separate issue, doing retirement planning with folks, when you look at will their retirement resources last, a big impact is the inflation when you're looking at a retirement that might last 30, 40 years. One way that I help people try to understand the impact that inflation will have on their portfolio is I'll say, you know, to them, think about how much you paid for your first home and how much you paid for your last car, and oftentimes that number is very close.
It's amazing.
It is.
The $20,000 car was the cost of a home in 1950 or
something. Right. It illustrates the impact of inflation over your lifetime.
Did you want to add something, Brian?
Well, you made a comment earlier when you were talking to Michelle about the fact that people don't usually think about this until there's some sort of immediate need, and I think that's a pretty common characteristic for human beings. We're not good long-term planners. We look at the short term. And you may be familiar with this this research, Michelle, the they did a research project where they were interested in looking at retirement savings. And Merrill Lynch has picked up on the results of this research. And now on their website, you can take a picture of yourself with your computer camera, and the software will make you look older, make you age. And they've discovered that when they show people that picture of themselves older, they say that they would save more for retirement. Mm. So there's something about really imagining yourself being older that might actually change your behavior.
So finally, a practical use for the selfie, right?
Okay. Another big part of this is that people who are older, you or me, for instance, not the other two here.
Stop pointing at me. Yeah.
Well, we're both about the same age. But basically, as you age, you tend to not want to tell your children what preparations you've made. And so what happens is something goes wrong. You break your hip or you become demented, and suddenly the family has no idea where you are, what is there, and it's absolutely key that there is these discussions way ahead of time in financial planning and also in what you want to have done. So it's not just financial, but what do you want to have done health-wise, what sort of things do you want to keep involved with, you know, where do you want to live, near your children or a long way away? Everybody should choose to live near their children, because you're going to need somebody to help you, and you're either going to have to pay for them or live near that child who you think won't do anything for you, but they'll be better than nobody.
Important. What's the old joke about be nice to your kids, because one of these days they're going to be having the responsibility of taking care of you.
Totally true.
Again, anything to add to that comment,
well,
Brian?
I think that's very wise, because when pay attention to how you're taking care of your parents, because your kids are watching you do that.
Right.
And they're learning about what's expected of them by watching middle-aged kids take care of their older parents.
I'm guessing this is a conversation that does not take place in many families. Michelle, I'm guessing you see this in your business.
Yes.
And Brian and Dr. Moreland.
Every family is different, of course, but I encourage people to, at the very least, write their wishes down and let their family know where to find, you know, your contacts for financial advisors and your attorney and your accountant and your wishes.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Let's go to the phone. Scott's been waiting in Chesterfield, and thank you for your patience, Scott. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, David Bratt says that seniors, they take out $3 from the government for every $1 they put into it, and he seems to think that's a bad thing. Do you agree with him?
Well, I'll jump in there and say, first of all, that's only when you don't take inflation into account. If you take inflation into account, actually seniors have put a lot of money into the system and allowed the system to grow and built the system. So number one, we shouldn't keep on bitching about the fact that seniors are taking back what they were promised. I think that's a very important part. But I think the other part of it is to recognize that we've all got to work towards a future which the government can afford if they just stopped arguing with one another. They waste a lot of money on things, you know, that bridge to nowhere, I'll never forget it, but all sorts of things we waste money on, and we don't want to put money into social resources. The big difference between Europe and the United States is money goes into social resources, and it makes a huge difference down the line to the functionality of people. So I think I'm going to disagree strongly that seniors are not really the burden. The burden is young people who don't really want to make sure that we have the adequate social resources.
But, Brian, let's look at Social Security. I mean, clearly, young people today are concerned about whether or not it's even going to be there when they're there. But if you take retirement, Social Security retirement at 65 and you live another 20 years, you're definitely going to be taking out more than you ever put in.
And there are many proposals on the table now to think about reformulating how Social Security is going to work to make sure that it's still going to be viable for the next generations when they come through. So we have some hard public policy conversations that we need to have focused on Social Security, Medicare. But I think that it can be dangerous to pose this situation as one of us versus them, young versus old, because the reality is that everybody, if they're lucky enough, is going to get old. So to frame it as young people versus old people, I think, is risky, because those young people are going to be old themselves one day, and they need to be part of the conversation to figure out how to solve it so that their old age is what they want it to be.
Michelle, when you're advising a 40-year-old and putting things away for retirement for those later years, what do you tell them with regard to Social Security? Don't count on it, count on it.
I tell them to go ahead and count on it, but it could look different than, I would suspect it might look a little different than it does now as far as the full retirement age. And I have a conversation with them, and if they want to count on less than what their benefit statement says, then we will go ahead and mark that down a bit. I would like to make a comment to add on to the Social Security discussion. I go to many conferences a year, and I have a lot of continuing education credits I have to get, and so I choose to go to a lot of the Social Security education. And I've gone to many educational credits that say that there are a lot of different ways that we can fix Social Security. It is not in serious jeopardy like we hear a lot of politicians say. It's fixable. The challenge is, like you said, it'd be an unpopular fix because someone has to step up and do the right thing. I also want to address this myth that the life expectancy in 1940, when Social Security was created, was 53 for males, and therefore no one was expected to live long enough to get it. The life expectancy in 1940 was 53 if you were born in 1953, but the infant mortality rate was so low.
Well, let's...
Oh, 1940.
1940. You said if you were born in 53.
I did. I misspoke.
Okay. Just clarify that and we'll move on.
Was age 53 for a male. It was such a terrible infant mortality rate that you weren't expected to live to 65. However, if you were an adult at age 21 in 1940, you had a life expectancy of 77. And so you were expected to enjoy the benefits of Social Security from age 65 to age 77. So it's often said that when Social Security first came out, you weren't expected to enjoy the benefits very long, but that's actually a myth.
All right. Well, that, you know, I've heard that all of my life. So
I believed
that
many years.
Thank you for clarifying that. Do you see it the same way, Brian?
Sure, that's absolutely true. And, I mean, we understand the big difference is that about 60% of the population got to close to 80 in 1940. Now we're at about 85, going up to about 95. So it increases the burden. There is a difference, but still, we were always going to have to spend money. And we're going to have to continue to spend money if we want to be a reasonable, nice set of people. If we don't want to be humane and we want to just shoot old people when they reach 65, which would get rid of me, so that's okay. But basically, we have to be realistic about this. And the money is there. The biggest problem is fixing Medicare, much bigger problem than Social Security, because of the huge increase in costs of medicine. But a lot of that is unnecessary costs, easily fixable. You know, if people would live on the $4 a month medicines except when they really needed something else, and the physicians could be taught not to give the newest medicine as it comes out, if we could not have three or four CTs or MRIs every time we go into a hospital, we can stop a lot of this cost and bring it down into reality. Then the Social Security fix becomes very easy once we fix Medicare, I think.
I have to stop it there to take another break. We'll do that. You just heard from Dr. John Morley, Director of the Division of Geriatric Medicine at St. Louis University. He's with me in studio, as is Brian Carpenter, who conducts research on aging. He also teaches a course called When I'm 64, Transforming Your Future at Washington University. And Michelle Clark is with us, a financial advisor and founder of Clark Hourly Financial Planning. Welcome back to continue the conversation. And again, I'd very much like to get your input. I'm sure there are a lot of questions out there with regard to this question of longevity and dealing with the wonderful prospect of living a long life. But what kind of quality of life can we expect to have? Back in just a moment with our guests. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We continue our conversation on longevity with Dr. John Morley, Brian Carpenter, and Michelle Clark. I'll go right to the phones and bring in Paul. Paul, thanks for being with us. You're on the air.
Hi, all. I just wanted to get the panel's perspective. I appreciate the input of a lot of things that have been said. It strikes me, though, that many of the suggestions seem to be very intuitive. I think each of us knows what we need to do, walking more, watching what we eat, taking care of our health, and preparing for retirement. But yet the focus of what I hear the panel saying is the government has to step in and do more. It seems to me that each of us knows what we need to do. And with $18 trillion in debt nationally, I think it's going to be incumbent upon each individual to make sure that we can age with dignity.
Thanks very much for the call, Paul. Dr. Morley, you're doing our political things today. Okay. Conversation.
So first of all, we should all have common sense and do what we can do. Unfortunately, we're human beings, and most human beings, including myself, do not have as much common sense as we should have. We need help at times. The national debt is a partial fantasy, depending on how you want to look at it. But if we cut back on the things we don't need in this country and put stuff into social services, looking after the people who really need it, and I'm not saying look after everybody who's over the age of 65. You know, that's not what we should be doing. We should be giving services and good services that are cheap and cost-effective to the people who need them. So we're not asking for anything that is different from what any reasonable citizen would expect. And I think we have to recognize that and not get lost in big numbers that often none of us understand and which are unintelligible except to politicians.
Brian Carpenter, this brings to the table, though, something that we've talked about on this program a lot, and that is the influence of poverty and low-income status on the whole issue of aging. There was a survey done recently in St. Louis called For the Sake of All, in which it was determined that people from the poorer zip codes would live an average of 18 fewer years than those in the more affluent zip codes. It is a big part of the issue, and help's got to come from someplace.
Right, and I think that you point out, you make an important point there, because the older population is more diverse than any other age group on every metric you can possibly imagine in terms of income, education, everything. So you really have to think about the diversity of the aging experience. And there are some people who are going to grow old, and they'll have ample resources and ample social connections, ample education, and they'll age in a very different way than people who haven't had those opportunities and advantages. So we have to make sure that we have systems in place to help people when they need that kind of help, and pair that in with initiatives to make sure that people can make smart choices, be motivated to do the things that they need to do for themselves.
Michelle, the reality is that these people that we're talking about in this lower socioeconomic level are people you're probably not going to see.
You know, I don't see them in my office. You know, I do see them occasionally at the pro bono types of events that I do. And, you know, what we do is we help them with what we can with the budgeting and that sort of thing, and then we send them to United Way has a 411 helpline. They can get them to the right resources. But your caller said something that I thought was interesting, and he said that a lot of what we said was intuitive kind of advice. And I would have to say that some of the things that I see people do, some very common mistakes, are things that people say, you know, I wish I would have known that earlier. Some things that people can do to help themselves if they are going to live longer and they wish they had known earlier are very simple things like, you know, if you get a raise, don't spend it, for heaven's sakes. You know, save at least 1% more every year. If you get a 3% raise, put 1% in your 401k until you get it maxed out. And then if you're maxed out, go ahead and save in a taxable account. I can't tell you how many people say, you know, I didn't know I was supposed to save more than what I put in the 401k. If you are going to work for 30 years and you're going to be retired for 40 years, you can't spend all your money while you're working and expect to pay bills for while you're working and retired both by living on by just saving in your 401k. It will not work.
What's the ideal age to start planning for your financial planning for retirement? 21?
I'm not kidding you. I got 2 shares of stock when I was about, I don't know the real age, 6 or 8. I need to look this up. And I started putting babysitting money when I was 13 years old into that account. And I bought my first house with my husband with that money. And then when I graduated from college, I started saving in my 401k. And you have to do that. when you graduate from college, you must start saving your 401k right away.
Right.
You have to.
But Michelle, a lot of people just don't have the money day to day. And I mean, we can argue that that's because the minimum wage was too low. There are lots
yes.
of things we can argue about, but we still have to find a way to help those people. And I think that's the pushback we often hear is
right.
that the government shouldn't be helping those people. I mean, I can get Social Security.
Right.
I don't need it. And the government should not be giving it to me, quite honestly, in my own opinion,
right.
you know.
You know, one area that
Quick
I
fix.
Think is common among all socioeconomic areas is food. The food budget is the most common discretionary area. And this weekend, my family, we put put together a basket for a food bank. And I went online and I put together some money for some food for scratch cooking kind of situation. And I saw that a lot of the other baskets that were put together were all processed food.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, the basket I put together will last a month. But the other baskets, they're going to eat their Pop-Tart and it's gone. And I think that what you could do is, if you are, in, like you said, in these poverty zip codes, learn to cook like your grandma cooked. Because beans and rice will last a long time and take the difference. But don't buy Pop-Tarts. And that might be a start.
If you can find in the poor neighborhood some place to buy anything when it comes to
Thank
food.
I agree.
That's a big issue. We have an email here from Dana. Says, what about people who are old and have no close family? It seems to be assumed that everyone has children or close friends and family, but what about those who don't? And there are many who don't. Go ahead, Brian.
I think there are some people who are single by choice. And I think it's important to recognize that they're in that situation because they prefer it that way. And there are other people who are by themselves because all of their friends have died, they don't have family. And those are folks who may be looking for companionship, looking for more social opportunities, and we need to find ways to give them those kinds of opportunities to them. You know, St. Louis is a pretty good place to be an old person. There are lots of resources around town, lots of organizations that have activities, supports for older adults. And so those people who don't have a lot of people in their life, there are resources in the community to make them better connected.
Keep your eyes open, folks, and find out what's going on all around you because a lot is happening. Let's go back to the phones. We'll bring in Tom calling from Wildwood. Tom, go ahead.
Hi. Back in the summer of 2001, there was a $17 trillion surplus in the economy, and there was some talk then about applying some of that money to correct some of the potential problems with Social Security. Fall of 2001 came along, and everybody sort of forgot about the surplus. Can you tell me how that lost its steam and what happened? Do you know what happened to the $17 trillion surplus? And I'd like to put that in perspective against the people that want to whine about an $18 trillion deficit now.
So can we say Iraq and Afghanistan and some other really stupid things? There may be a real financial reason, but I think most of us realize that the government around the time of 2001 did some really silly things that were very difficult to justify and cost us a lot of money. And we're still paying for that at this stage. So, Michelle, do you have a better reason why we finished up losing all this money?
Well, there was an economic decline at the same time, too. As I recall, the stock market went down. I guess dots were connected.
It all sort of went together. We got ourselves into a real mess after 2001, and we could argue that the same people who got us into that real mess caused the stock market to go down, too. But that's far too political. Okay.
That hasn't seemed to bother you in the past. But back to the phones, unless, Brian, you have something to add. Let's bring in Diane calling from Glendale. Diane, go ahead.
Hi. I've really been enjoying your discussion, but most of it has seemed to focus on financial planning and how to age well. But my question is why I have not heard any public discussion since Dr. Kevorkian was demonized about allowing people to end their own life with dignity if they have a terminal illness or for whatever reason. You don't even hear that discussed anymore, and I'm wondering why that is.
Diane, thank you so much for the call. Brian, do you want to pick up on that?
Well, this is a conversation that's happening in lots of different places, not just in the United States, but also in some states here. And there are some states in this country where people have more choice about when they're going to die. Missouri isn't one of those places, but there are initiatives that are kind of working their way through the pipeline around the country. It's, as you can imagine, a sensitive topic, and people have really different opinions about it. I think that the challenge, before Missouri gets to the place where we give people that choice, I think there's a lot of steps we can take to make sure that when people are approaching the end of their life, that we can try to preserve some quality to that life by making sure that their pain is well managed, by making sure that they're in a place that they want to be. Hospice and palliative care are two widely available services that have that as its aims. They are trying to make the quality of life for people near the end of their life as good as it can possibly be. And I encourage people to learn more about those services, to ask for those services, and to plan for those services when they are facing a serious illness.
I think the hospice piece is a very important part. Before we rush in to say we should go further and end life, we have large numbers of people in Missouri who are not ready to say, I'm going to stop futile care, which is one of the reasons our medicine costs so much. And really and honestly, people who go into hospice, all the studies now show that they live longer, sometimes as much as 3 to 4 months longer by going into hospice, cost less, get a better quality of life. And I think that's the starting conversation. Beyond that, Holland has struggled with most probably the most advanced approach to end of life, where people can make a choice. And really and honestly, it's not an easy decision, and it requires a lot of different ethical decisions, and mistakes are going to be made many times. It's like saying, well, when a baby's born, well, I don't like what you look like, so therefore we will just not let you go on and choose another baby to go on. It's very complex. I think we've got many things we can do before we start to go along the line of euthanasia.
I'll take another phone call as the time begins to wind down. We'll bring in Marie calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Marie. Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, sort of almost along the line of the same last question, but do doctors really think that all people want to be 120 years old? I mean, is that the goal? I think a lot of people are terrified of living that long for all the reasons you've been mentioning today.
Marie, I can tell you that most of the people I work with who are in their 60s to 90s don't want to be 120, but many of them struggle when it gets to the end of life to say, well, I'm ready to stop and give up. So we are conflicted in these things, and I think that's part of the conversation that we really need to have much more. There have been a number of programs on hospice and end of life on this program, and they really are very important that we get used to and realize that they're things we can do. Most of us, I think if you're highly functional, I always come back to Jeanne Calmer, who was very functional at 122. She put out a rap record at 121 and was a bestseller in France. So, if I'm that way, I want to live to 122. If I'm like some of the people who are my patients and friends, I'm not certain I want to. So that's the choice. And as long as we're giving people a good system with good choices, I think we can make very big differences and help people make sensible choices, make the system cost less.
Only a little over a minute left. But Brian, I would just suggest that one of the things that people fear most is dementia, Alzheimer's disease. They see that on the horizon, and they don't want to get there.
Definitely. One of the most feared diseases in this country, second only to cancer. And it's a big problem, and unfortunately, the longer you live, it increases the likelihood that you might experience dementia at some point in your life. So that's another segment of care that we have to figure out how to provide.
And I'm sure you run into that, Michelle Clark, as well.
Yes, unfortunately, we do.
Yeah.
And the Spanish study showed that olive oil a liter a week actually slows down dementia dramatically, better than any drug we've got. So olive oil, olive oil, olive oil. Let's get my message out. I'm not selling for them.
A liter a week?
That's a lot.
It's a lot.
A liter of rosé wine, maybe, but of olive oil, that's a different thing altogether. Well, we're going to have to leave it at there. Is there any final thought that you can leave us with in 15 seconds? I'll give each of you. Can you do it in 15? 15 seconds, Dr. Morley?
You know I can't, but I think living long is good with good support services. It can be a lot of fun.
And plan for it, Brian?
Plan for it and start now.
Right. And I'm sure your message is exactly the same.
Yeah, I concur, yes.
Well, I want to thank you all so much for being with us. This is certainly a subject that all of us have to confront at one time or another. And I think one of the things that we've determined during the course of our discussion today is start thinking about it when you're young. And it'll make things a lot easier when you're older. Thank you very much. Dr. Morley, great to see you again. Brian Carpenter, thank you for being with us. And Michelle Clark, nice to have you with us as well. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with journalist Don Corrigan about his new book exploring environmental issues and options right here in the state of Missouri. And there are plenty of each. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.